Hi, so I'm Rebecca Schmidt, and I'll be talking about some evidence for gestational nutrition and their influences on autism risk with new findings on iron. So during pregnancy, nutrient demands are increased, and there are also changes in nutrient metabolism to compensate for these increased needs. This includes changes in GI absorption, renal excretion, and also how maternal storage and reserves are utilized. But the physiologic capacity to adjust metabolism is limited, and when this limit is exceeded, fetal growth and development can become impaired. But maternal behavioral changes can be implemented to augment these physiologic changes, primarily by increasing nutrients in the maternal diet. And this is the basis behind nutrient recommendations by the Institute of Medicine for recommended intakes of nutrients during pregnancy as compared to the non-pregnant state. And here's a list of some selected nutrient intakes during pregnancy. And you can see that the nutrient demands of some nutrients are great compared to others, including increases of over 50% in things like protein, iron, and folate. We also see what happens when nutrient demands are not met, and this in unfortunate events like famines, including the Dutch famine, where a German blockade of supplies, including food supplies, led to a famine during a particularly severe winter, and rations only provided less than half of what the normal caloric intake would be. But then when they were liberated, the caloric intake increased back up to normal levels, and so we have kind of a natural experiment of severe but brief undernutrition during pregnancy. And what this allows is studies to examine the association between severe undernutrition during very distinct periods of pregnancy. And so what these studies have found is that depending on the timing of the undernutrition, the outcomes are different, and especially in the later half of pregnancy, we see outcomes that relate to growth of the fetus. But during the earlier part of pregnancy, we see that there are neurodevelopmental consequences like neural tube defects and schizophrenia. So this makes sense because we know that from teratology studies that the brain has a critical window of susceptibility during the very early period of pregnancy, in the very first few weeks after conception, while the brain and spinal cord are formed with neural tube closure. But you can also see that the brain continues to develop all through pregnancy, and so it could be susceptible to other developmental issues throughout pregnancy. So what is the critical period for autism? Well, we know from brain pathology studies that show abnormalities in the brain that tend to affect processes that occur in the first half of pregnancy. We also know from exposure studies that have led to associations with risk of autism, for those that have been able to look at timing, the timing tends to suggest that there's an increased susceptibility more towards the first trimester of pregnancy, with a few exceptions. So what is the evidence for gestational nutrition in autism? One of the first studies done in 2011, there were a couple studies showing that risk for autism is increased when the interpregnancy interval is short. So you can see from this figure from Czeslak Postawa in 2011 that if a child who's born within a year of the prior birth has much higher risk for autism. And so what this can mean is that there was not enough time for maternal nutrient stores to replete after the previous pregnancy. This concept of short interpregnancy intervals has been associated with conditions that primarily have their susceptible periods near conception. That includes neural tube defects and schizophrenia. And without supplementation, we know that certain nutrients that might be behind this effect, as I mentioned, the ones that have the increased demands during pregnancy, like folate and iron, that are not necessarily repleted until long after the pregnancy ends. And so for folate, it's up to a year before those supplies are replenished. And for iron, it's similar, They're depleted, but it takes usually a little less time, around 4 to 6 weeks, for it to be repleted. But this is not the case for all women. Some go on to have deficiencies through breastfeeding. Then we also have evidence from the CHARGE study that Irva introduced, showing that taking a prenatal vitamin during pregnancy was associated with reduced risk for autism. And so here was the figure from that paper showing that in the first few months of pregnancy, so on the bottom we have the months before pregnancy, the green line is conception, and then the months throughout pregnancy. And on the x-axis we have the percent reporting taking a prenatal vitamin. And we show that the mothers of children with autism were significantly less likely to take a prenatal vitamin in the 3 months before pregnancy and the very first month of pregnancy. And that taking a prenatal vitamin during this period was associated with a significantly decreased risk for autism, about 40% reduction in risk. So what are the nutrients that are responsible for this association with prenatal vitamins? Again, folic acid and iron are prenatal vitamins that are contained at much higher levels, and typically those things are higher for most prenatal vitamins compared to multivitamins, which did not show an association in our study, but most women in both groups were not taking multivitamins. And so we started looking into folic acid because we already knew that folic acid could decrease risk for neural tube defects by up to 70%, especially for women and children that had the MTHFR variant, or the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase gene variant, which basically leads to inefficient folate metabolism. But even though we've known from the clinical trials that showed this protective effect of folic acid back in the early 90s, that led to fortification in the United States, we still don't know the mechanism behind this protective effect after decades of research. But what we do know is that folate is required for DNA synthesis, cell division, methylation reactions, and one of the prevailing hypotheses is that DNA methylation might be involved. So what is DNA methylation? It's the addition of a one carbon group or a methyl group to DNA that impacts the gene expression, usually inhibiting transcription. DNA methylation is influenced by other environmental exposures. So studies show that population air pollution or exposures to toxicants can usually decrease the global levels of DNA methylation. And to maintain normal DNA methylation patterns, dietary methyl donors are needed. We also know from both human and animal studies that the maternal supply of methyl donors, especially really early in pregnancy, right around conception, can affect the offspring's levels of global DNA methylation and individual site DNA methylation, and also the gene expression. And also in the animal studies, we see that this can influence the outcomes of the health for those offspring, as shown by these agouti mice you see, where they're genetically identical, but this brown sleek mouse has had a mom who had an ample supply of methyl donors in her diet compared to this genetically identical mouse that was born to a mother that did not have the ample supply of methyl donors. And you can see that this mouse is obese and is prone to diabetes, whereas this mouse is much healthier. This one case is where the methyl groups turned off a gene that happened to be leading to the obesity outcome. And the reason we think that this periconceptional period is so important for DNA methylation is because there's a period right after fertilization where the methylome is basically wiped out and reestablished right after implantation. And so here, as shown in this figure, where we have DNA methylation on the left axis, on the x-axis, and you can see that except for an imprinted genes, most of the genome is wiped out and reestablished. And so you can imagine that having an ample supply of methyl donors during this reestablishing the methylation patterns would be really important. So then we went on to quantify levels of folic acid in the CHARGE study that Irva talked about, and we saw that if we took the levels of folic acid from all the sources in this study, which included prenatal vitamins, multivitamins, folic acid-specific vitamins, and also cereals and other supplements like breakfast shakes and protein bars, for a total mean daily intake of folic acid. We saw that mothers of children with autism spectrum disorder had lower intakes of folic acid, especially during the very first month of pregnancy, where there was a significant difference of almost or more than 100 micrograms. And during that same, and during that first month of pregnancy, we saw evidence for a dose trend such that the highest levels of folic acid were associated with the lowest risk for autism in the child. So we also looked at whether there were gene-environment interactions going on, and we found that, in general, periconceptional folic acid was associated with decreased risk for autism spectrum disorders, especially for individuals, both mothers and children, that had inefficient 1-carbon metabolism, which relates to the folate and methylation pathways. But the limitations of these studies were that they were case-control studies, and as Irva mentioned, they were prone to recall bias, differences in the way the mom, how accurately the moms recalled their intake of vitamins. And so, but it was in line with, at the time, with evidence showing that folic acid during early pregnancy was also associated with fewer behavioral problems, attention and peer problems, and also improved language and social competence in several prospective cohort studies that were not susceptible to recall bias. Then, just this year, we had a new study come out, also replicating our findings, showing that periconceptional folic acid was associated with reduced risk for autism in a large prospective cohort study of over 85,000 children in Norway, where they had almost the exact same effect size of 0.6, so a 40% reduction in risk associated with taking folic acid supplements. So we think that the evidence for folic acid is pretty strong, but what about iron? So again, in the CHARGE study, so iron deficiency is the most commonly measured nutrient deficiency worldwide, but also in the United States, where up to 50% of pregnancies are affected by iron deficiency, and which also goes on to early infancy. The fetus depends on maternal iron as its only source of iron, and so if maternal iron deficiency occurs, it can induce fetal and infant iron deficiency. Iron is known to be crucial to neural development, and iron deficiency early in life produces impairments in cognition, motor development, social orientation and engagement, and language development. In the brain, iron contributes to neurotransmitter production, myelination, and immune function, and dysregulation of all three of these pathways has been associated with autism spectrum disorders. Studies also show a higher prevalence of iron deficiency in children with autism spectrum disorders, and this is thought to be due to their selective dietary habits. However, we think there's also a possibility that they have differences in metabolism or uptake of iron. So again, in the CHARGE case control study, we took a look at the percent of women reporting taking iron supplements during pregnancy and the 3 months before and during breastfeeding. And what we saw was that mothers of children with autism spectrum disorder were somewhat less likely to take a prenatal vitamin, or I mean, take an iron supplement during the later half of pregnancy and breastfeeding. And during the whole entire index period, which includes 3 months before pregnancy all the way through breastfeeding, we saw that about 24% of cases and 31% of controls took a iron supplement, leading to a crude odds ratio of about 0.75 that was not quite meeting significance. However, after we adjusted for folic acid and other confounders, the odds ratio was about 0.6 and was significant. So when we looked at iron intake by the sources, we see that prenatal vitamins do provide the largest source of iron, and iron supplements were second. But the total mean iron intake was, again, significantly lower in the mothers of children with autism spectrum disorders. And so here's the iron, mean iron intake from all sources quantified together and showing by month, where we see that on the bottom we have stars where it's significantly different. The moms took typically less iron than the moms of typically developing children. And you can see that in the first few months of pregnancy, the few months before pregnancy, that mothers of children with autism spectrum disorder were not meeting the green line, which is represents the Institute of Medicine's dietary recommended intake for iron, but that the moms of typically developing children were. But you can also see that during pregnancy, all of the women were exceeding the levels that was recommended by the Institute of Medicine for optimal health and also during breastfeeding. So also looking at the quintiles of iron intake, we see that the very highest quintile of iron intake, which was above 86 milligrams a day, was associated with the most reduced risk of autism, and that's the unadjusted model. And then in the adjusted model, adjusting for folic acid intake and other confounders, we see that on this side that it's still, the association still holds, and then also when we impute missing data, which we had a bit of, it still stands. So this is just the first evidence of an association between maternal iron and autism spectrum disorders. But there are limitations, again, there's a possibility of recall bias and inaccuracy of reporting, and also a lack of dietary information on iron, which is a large source of iron intake. And we also have high correlation between iron and folic acid, and even though we've adjusted for it, they tend to go together. But I also want to caution that even though the highest category of iron intake was associated with a reduced risk for autism, we know that really high levels of iron can be toxic, and so I don't want to promote the fact that more iron is better necessarily. But I think it does lead us to give us reason to look at identifying which individuals do need more iron, and maybe just to promote, not just to prevent deficiency, but maybe insufficiently for certain people who might be genetically susceptible to insufficiency. And also, there are a lot of metabolic conditions like obesity and diabetes that are gaining in prevalence in the United States, and those conditions lead to iron deficiency. So one thing we did do is take a look at iron intake, this time with the lowest quintile, and then looking at whether the mother had a metabolic condition, including obesity and diabetes and hypertension. And we saw that the mothers who had these metabolic conditions and had the lowest quintile of iron intake, their children were at the highest risk for developing autism. So I think this is something that needs to be looked into a little bit further. So what other nutrients have been associated with autism? So there have been a couple other studies, not too many, that have looked at any nutrients. And one such study was done in the Nurses' Health Study, which you've heard about. And that showed that there was increased risk for autism associated with omega-6 fatty acids and an increased risk for low omega-3 intake. But these findings were cautioned as preliminary, and I think more work needs to be done on that. Fatty acids are really important for neural development, and I think there need to be more studies. And then also there was a study showing that maternal serum vitamin D levels were not associated with autism phenotypes in a general population study, but they did not look at autism diagnoses. And I think there's a lot of animal evidence showing that vitamin D is also involved in neurodevelopment and could play a role. So in summary, I think nutritional factors could potentially play a role in autism etiology, as it does in other neurodevelopmental conditions. And we need to identify which nutrients are potentially involved and work out dietary strategies and also figure out the mechanisms or pathways that are involved. And doing this, we could facilitate prevention of autism spectrum disorders. I'd like to thank all my collaborators, especially Irva, who's PI on charge, and also the funders and the charge participants. Thanks.